For April the 30th, 2020, we talk about Nowhere Prophet, Phasmophobia, and we ask you about long-lasting scary game moments. Welcome to Level 348. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm David Meismith.
And I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Welcome back. Welcome, everybody, here. I want to open up with a programming note. We talked about this, I believe, last week or 2 weeks ago. Though we are here with an episode this week, that recording time falls on election night here in the United States, and we're not going to be doing an episode that week. I will be unable to concentrate on anything else. I know we're not going to get results back that night, but, you know, gotta make sure that I take care of myself there. So
yeah,
I just remember last time in 2016, all of that.
So. Yeah, we kind of messed it up by ending the show and then having to deal with it by ourselves for the rest of the night.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Skipping next episode is an investment in future episodes.
Yes. Yeah. With that, go ahead.
On that note, I voted over the weekend. So, oh, cool.
Did you go in person or did you mail in a ballot or?
No, Washington's voting system is like 100% the best that I've ever seen. They mail you the ballot like 2 to 3 weeks before the election day. You fill it out whenever you have time. You drop it off at a ballot box whenever you have time. There's a bunch around the city all year round. And yeah, it's nice. Quite easy. And it was better than like I had 2 hours so I could like sit and research issues and stuff. Mm-hmm. So if there's like candidates I knew nothing about, I could go and look them up and then make an informed decision instead of just being in the ballot box and just being like, well, I guess I'll pick the Democrat.
I'll vote for the woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. And Dennis, you said that you voted this week as well?
Yeah, we did the same. You request a ballot in advance, fill it out, and then drive it to a drop-off box. And we got to take the kids along. It was a whole opportunity to talk with them about that. And nice. I think I've talked on the show about how they're kind of aware of what's going on, but not really.
And that's probably where they want to be.
Yeah, I feel it's the right amount of awareness of election season for a six-year-old.
Yes.
But yeah, they were pumped. And there was traffic. I didn't see any lines to vote, but there was a long line of cars going in. And so once we got to the point where like, you know, people voting in person go this way, people dropping off go the other way, there was no wait. Like we were one of a few people dropping off. But I didn't see like lines out the door or anything like that. But there were a lot of people voting early, as all the statistics say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So no, good.
Early voting started here on Saturday. And I kind of feel like I should do that. But on the other hand, I looked up my voting precinct. And if I do it on election day, it's not actually in the church, but it's in like the, I don't know, outreach annex for the church that was like where George Washington went to church when he was president and where Alexander Hamilton's buried and stuff like that. So I feel like that's kind of cool.
That's
like,
pretty cool.
Obviously, that has nothing to do with actually voting, but part of me still kind of wants to do that.
Yeah.
Well, you could vote early and then just go down there on election day and see it. get both.
Oh, yeah.
A PSA that I learned from my mom who works the polls is they're not allowed to turn away people for not wearing masks. That's considered somehow voter intimidation if you require wearing masks.
Huh, yeah.
So they can suggest you wear one, they can offer you one, but people, there very likely could be people there if you're going day of, who are not wearing masks or being germy. Like it's going to be an interesting thing if you're waiting till day of. So get that ballot in early.
Yeah.
See, what I don't get about that rule is that seems like if I'm in particular Trump's war, that creates a really, really easy way to do voter intimidation.
It's just, so I want to be clear. You are not a Trump supporter. You are saying if you were a Trump supporter, it would be really easy to go in there and just start coughing on people to get them to leave.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
It's a bummer that it's being treated as like a political issue and not a health issue.
Welcome to America, baby. We're back. Oh, woo. Yeah. No, I guess
we're really on board with freedom of thought. You can think whatever you want here, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I have made it my completely idiotic and like purposeless, but mission to, you know, a whole bunch of people complaining about like, oh, you can't breathe the mask. So just to see how many just weird things I can do while wearing a mask.
Yeah, God, really, really frustrating. And yeah, so please vote. Please vote for Democrats. Please, at the very least, vote against Trump. I think that would be the show's line, the network's line. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn. Having spoken with everybody here, I think we're probably on board for that. Maybe.
I think the most important question is, has Greta endorsed a candidate?
Ooh, good question.
Greta has endorsed whoever will keep Dottie away from her. No, that is not true. They like being around each other.
Hardline stance on immigration.
Ooh. No, they're getting along just fine. Yeah. So David, you weren't here last week. You've been doing anything cool?
Oh, this is going to mean a lot more probably to you guys. There's a singer or was a singer for a band called like Velvet Underground. That's like Nika? Lou someone.
Lou Reed.
Lou Reed.
Yeah. Yeah. So apparently he was super into Tai Chi and is kind of like, I don't know quite what the term is, but like posthumously going to be like publishing a documentary on it.
Hmm.
Oh. And so I went and there's basically on YouTube on Sunday, kind of seminar talk, that sort of thing that was, you know, a whole bunch of people that knew him, so like a bunch of music producers and stuff like that, just, you know, talking about his and their experience with Tai Chi. Again, I'm not super into music, so I don't know. Like, the only person whose name I'd heard was Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
Sure.
And so, like, I don't know. It was just kind of cool, kind of interesting, just hearing these, you know, different people's perspectives on, like, you know, what that meant to them, you know, how it helped, you know, them deal with, like, the craziness that is, you know, touring and things like that.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have anything to add about that or ask about it, but...
Yeah. It was one of those things. It was spur of the moment. Like, someone else in my group posted on Facebook and just jumped on. So yeah, it was just a very interesting experience.
Nice. Dennis, how about you? Anything cool going on?
We hit my highlight, which was going to drop off votes.
Cool.
That was the big activity.
Yeah. How about you, Ben?
I'll talk about what I did over the weekend on what you've been playing section.
Yeah. Let's do that. Let's get into the show. I don't really have anything. I just, it's all the same bullshit, but we've got the regular kind of show for you, the grind, the multiplayer and the end boss. And why don't we get started with
the grind.
Hey, quick note here. Dennis's voice is going to intermittently get really low in tone. And I do not know how to fix that. So you can still understand them. Just understand that there's some like stretching going on that I do not know how to account for. Okay. Back to the episode. The grind, where we talk about the games we have been playing over the past period of time or so. David, you've been away the longest. So I will go to you.
Sorry, I'm in the kind of... you know, coronavirus, like, time is irrelevant thing where where it's like now like, oh, I need to load up Xbox Game Pass so it can tell me what I've been playing.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I do that with my Steam activity every time we record too, or it's like, what have I played in the last week?
Yeah. So jumped back in to Fallout 76. Okay. You know, they had I don't think I mentioned last time they had a event last week was in the Fallout universe, the week that the bombs fell.
Okay.
Oh,
and so they had kind of a week-long in-game kind of holiday because they're dead set on all parts of this game must not understand Fallout's stance on nuclear war.
Right.
The jury's out, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, was it like a bomb dependence day kind of thing? Like they tried to make it a celebration?
No, it's more just like the game, this game in general, like it's been noted for being kind of weird that, you know, in the Fallout games, the, you know, bombs have always been presented as like, you know, not at all a good thing. Whereas now, like the end game dungeon is basically you like getting access to a nuke and dropping it somewhere.
Yeah, just a weird like a weird little tonal shift, tonal creep that started with Fallout 3 where you could detonate Megaton.
Tone deaf.
Right. How,
but that wasn't like glorifying it, right? It cut off like an entire part of the game for you.
No, I mean, but it opened up another part as well. Yeah.
It presented it as a choice that could be made for a given run rather than something that would fundamentally set the scene for everything that happens after it.
When God nukes a door, he opens up a window or something.
So this, to be fair, like none of this is reflected in game. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not that. Well, I mean, other than just the event, but like no one calls it like bomb drop day or whatever they call it an event. It's more just, you know, it's more just something that's weird and kind of silly.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'm working my way through the actual, kind of mini, you know, plot line, that they've been, introducing with the Wastelanders expansion. It's actually pretty good. You know, it's interesting. You know, they do a fairly good job of having the two factions both be fairly compelling. There's a sequence I really like that's kind of getting back to the old Fallout satire, where you basically have to... One of the big plot points this time around is kind of the tension between... the automation of the mining and so like labor relations, that sort of thing. And so with this, in one of the sections you're going through the CEO of one of these mining companies and you know, kind of him writing, and he's like, yeah, I remember my dad always telling me that, you know, the most important part of the company was the employees, and you know, never to forget that. And so that's why I'm making sure to replace all the employees with robots so that, you know, we have the strongest employees we can. It's just, you know, blatantly missing the point.
Yeah.
Or it's like, okay, that's more like the satire that this game has kind of needed.
Right.
So, yeah, other than that, and I assume we'll be talking about some of the stuff we've been, you know, playing together a bit, but I rechecked out World of Horror to kind of see what progress it's been made.
Yeah, they added some new some new modules, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. So a couple of new mysteries, a lot of new characters. The other thing they've really filled out is a lot of the, I guess, kind of enemy-specific options. So, for example, ghosts now, you can no longer attack with, you know, regular weapons. And then a lot of the characters that kind of, like, cultist things, you now have the option in combat to basically listen to their like ranting, and you'll take a hit to your sanity, but you'll learn a spell.
Okay.
And then there's a bunch of them, particularly some of the bosses, stuff like that, will have alternate like ways of defeating them. So, for example, one of the bosses is doing kind of the Uzumaki, where like half that story takes place in a hospital,
right?
And you have a enemy that's basically preying on, you know, drawing sustenance on people on life support.
Mm-hmm.
And so you now have the option, you can just like take a penalty to sanity and just tear the people off life support and kill them.
So they won't be harvested.
Right. And so that like the boss you're fighting that's feeding on him will die, basically.
Oh, nice.
That is way less entertaining version of The Matrix, where Keanu wakes up in the real world and just starts ripping life support out of everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Again, as you can kind of tell with that example, you know, still doing a great job of keeping the, like, let's make everything as creepy and unsettling as possible.
As it should be.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Still seems really good. I really want someone needs to do, I don't know, some sort of spoiler-free wiki that is, what are all of the pop culture references and stuff like that?
Oh, it's like this particular monster is drawn from this manga or from this urban legends, like that kind of thing.
Right. Because there's a lot of that. Like, you can straight up, for example, meet a character that is a incredibly thinly veiled kind of, I don't know, in-world version of Junji Ito.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. Like, there's a bunch of things like that.
I wonder if, and these are usually updated depending on the community, TV Tropes often has shout out pages for individual works. So maybe you can go and take a look at that and see. I create recording problems when I browse the web while I am talking with you guys. I'm not going to go look at it because that will ruin everything. But that is a place where I have gone to look and see what references what.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good idea. So other than that, I'm just waiting for Watchdog Legion to come out on Thursday.
Oh, so nice.
I'm looking forward to next week discussing how not political that game is.
Because Ubisoft, they don't have any backbone whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just, well, it's almost though at this point, it's like, you realize, like, no one was complaining like, oh, is Doom Eternal making a statement? Like, this only happens to you because of the games you make.
Right. Although people did complain because I don't think they said something like, they didn't say Demon Lives Matter, because that would have sucked. In one of the early trailers for Doom Eternal, like, they were talking about, basically implying that the demons were some kind of immigrant and trying to take humor from that. And the tack that they were taking wasn't like them actually expressing anything intentionally. I think that, you know, a thing about the most recent batch of Doom games, these two, is there is a certain like corporate banality to it, where, right, you know, like the HR department, you know, has a folder about how to deal with, you know, demon sightings and stuff like that. But people were up in arms a little bit. I understand what you're saying though. Ubisoft tends to make games and then not make statements with them.
As a side point, given that Doom is run on something called id Software, they probably shouldn't go out of their way to make political points.
Probably not.
But it's kind of like, you know, have you considered, like, maybe not releasing your game 5 days before Election Day?
Maybe, possibly.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man.
They were counting on the Trump takeover being complete and there not being an Election Day.
I can't even joke about it, man. Oh, man. But yeah, I need to go back to World of Horror. I should probably do a stream and focus on the new mysteries that they put up.
This is entirely off topic. It's literally just what Xbox Game Pass thinks I should be playing next. But am I the only one that, and maybe we've discussed this before, like Dead by Daylight is a game I will never play, but will definitely spend hours reading the lore entries on the wiki.
I tweeted about this because when they announced that they were adding Silent Hill content to it, I tweeted like, God, now I'm going to have to learn what the fuck Dead by Daylight is. And people gave a short summary of what it is. It's very hard to, it feels like a product from an alternate universe to me.
Which is good because it's a product set in an alternate universe.
Well, as most games are.
I just see it as a less good Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
But with better lore. And maybe with Friday the 13th in it?
It could be a superset of that game, yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, I know it has the Scream guy and I think it has Freddy Krueger.
It does have Freddy, yeah. And Michael Myers. It has like everyone except for Jason.
Given the legal situation around the Friday the 13th game, though, that's probably explainable.
Ah.
Yeah. Did you have anything else that you were doing, David?
Nope. That's all I have.
He cool. has one thing for wow. sure that he's been doing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'll take us into that because we might as well. Let's talk about this. We over the weekend, you guys hopped on and we streamed along with Jala as well. Phasmophobia, the game that Ben has been talking about here for a while, for a few weeks, where you and a bunch of other people go into Unity asset houses and hunt for ghosts using any number of special ghost hunting tools. But yeah, we all hopped on. It was one of the most chaotic gaming experiences I've had.
But it was so uneventful. There were only two deaths.
Yep. Yeah. It was a little bit of a bummer because like everybody who hopped in the chat was like, oh, I'm ready to watch them scream. And, you know, it's like, are you ready to have everybody running around or whatever? And like, we never really got the ghost to spawn except for twice, a couple of times. Like we couldn't even determine what the ghost was because like one of the devices didn't work.
Yeah, so I was scratching my head about this the rest of the weekend because, like, I've played it even since then, and it's like, so my guess is that maybe they do something with the level of your characters, and like that kind of like changes the difficulty, maybe.
Oh, and it so was it's like just a scaling like, thing. Yeah,
that's the only rational explanation I could come up with, where it's like it just looks at the party and sees three level one or level two people, and it's just like maybe we'll just come to break some difficulty of this ghost. Because,
I know also it's like, or at least my understanding is on the lowest difficulty level, which is what we were for most of it, because that's like all what most of us had unlocked. The ghost cannot attack before like 2 minutes have passed.
5 minutes.
Right. Okay. It can't begin hunting before 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. And so I wonder if some of it is just... like, we probably, like, I don't know, I feel like it's one of those things where it's, if you come at the game from a fairly gameplay standpoint, like, it's very easy to have basically gotten most of the evidence within 5 minutes.
Yeah, especially with the team before that knows what they're doing, you can get in and out really quickly.
Yeah, there were a handful of times where we had it pretty much pinned down, and I think we hung around in order to see what would happen,
or get bonus objectives as well.
Yes, those bonus objectives. But, and I'm very curious because, like, does the game say, you know, when the game says gives you the bonus objective, you know, find dirty sink or like find a freezing spot. Does it guarantee that you're going to see those, right?
I'm pretty sure it does, but it does not guarantee, like, within the first 5 or 10 or 15 minutes that it'll show up then.
That's weird.
But, my understanding from what I read on the wiki, and, you know, Grant, this is both, one, it's a wiki, and two, this is a very new game. I think it's still early access, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Is that the objectives you get are guaranteed to be something you have bought an equipment for, but not necessarily something that the ghost can do.
Okay.
And it's also not necessarily something that you've brought as well. Because if you might have like a motion sensor, and if you don't bring it, you can still get an objective, like catch it with a motion sensor, and you're just SOL. Okay.
But you made the point about how fast you can identify it, or pretty much identify it in the early game if you know what you're doing, which means that the core gameplay of this loop is really how fast you can carry a thermometer from a van into a room.
And they kind of show this because the higher difficulty, quote unquote, maps are the high school and the asylum, which I think, do we do the high school once or
not? We did the high school. Once, yeah. That was the most fun that I had.
And that's like a big map. And we kind of got lucky that it was in one of the front rooms because it can definitely be in like the back corner or bathroom or something like that. The asylum is like 4 to 5 times bigger than the high school, at least.
Wow.
And so it's like, and that's kind of like how they pad the time. Like what you're talking about, Dennis, is like, they're just like, okay, well, we're just going to make it longer for you to figure out where the actual room is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The high school, I'm assuming Asylum pulls this in as well, has some neat mechanics in that, you know, being multi-floor, it can be difficult to tell. Like, one of the big tells is a phone ringing. Yeah. However, it's very difficult to tell, is that a phone, like, nearby on my floor or on one of the other floors?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I think is a real good touch is the gym is big enough that, like, you
can't see the other end of it.
Right, yeah. Your flashlight doesn't really reach, which is nice. But yeah, I'm hoping what I'd like to see is, you know, the game I'd kind of compare this to would be, you know, Hell's Sign. I mentioned that last time. And I feel like that, granted, that's like all the way around a much more action-focused game. So like, part of the reason that's delaying you is because, like, as you're, you know, figuring out the room where the ghost is, you're also occasionally fighting off giant spiders and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's not really appropriate for this. But I think what would be good is there's a lot of things in that where, like, every so often you'll go into a room and, like, the door will lock behind you and, like, a poltergeist will, like, throw something at you that you have to dodge. Mm-hmm. And I could see that, like, adding some kind of, like, I don't know, sort of micro threats that serve to slow you down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could. It's interesting to think about where this game could go development-wise. Like, yeah, they need to flesh out maybe some other objectives for what to do. It seems like there's a lot of different kind of seeds they planted. There's, like, you can pick up keys around a lot of the maps, and, like, there's this weird thing that I've noticed where it's actually really good about having these like random events that only show up like once every like 100 or 200 games, maybe, where it's like there's one where it's like the car alarm might go off and you have to find the key and then walk over to the car and like turn off the car alarm.
Oh, wow.
In the garage. Yeah. And there's like another one map I played where it was from one of the cabin levels. And there was like a script that the ghost would do where it would slam the front door shut and then it would knock really loudly on the front door. But the front door was locked and you couldn't open it.
Ha!
Yeah. It's cool to see like small things like buried in the gameplay like that. I'm not sure how many of them there are, but I think that's kind of how it should go. It's like have a lot of like tiny bespoke type of things like that that feel like really spooky.
Yeah. Another one that I haven't seen, but I feel like could be a really cool event is apparently the ghost writing book. The ghost can write in it while it's in your inventory.
Ooh. Yeah.
Which that's cool. I feel like that would be really cool as kind of, because like my understanding is that the game tracks like where the ghost is wandering around the house, even if like it's not currently visible or like messing with things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so like I think it'd be interesting if they had those things where it's like, all right, you now know that you wandered across the ghost, but you don't know when or where. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The sound design in this game is really good, by the way. Like, yes. I thought about this when you're talking about the phone ringing. You're not exactly sure where it is. All the sounds are really, really well designed. Like when you hear a creak, like in the floor or in the steps or something like that, you immediately like have a sense of where it is or where it's coming from. That's really well executed. And that's actually where I think the bulk of the horror of the game comes from. Like when the actual ghost appears itself, sometimes it can be startling, but a lot of it's like the sound of it, like hissing in your ears.
Yeah. The audio scares were way more effective on me than anything visual.
Those are the things that made me jump.
Yeah. Yeah. And the ghosts themselves are straight up like Amnesia 1 enemies.
There's a good variety. Like sometimes it's just like a shadow, like a silhouette, and that can be scary. Sometimes it looks like a traffic victim, like mutilated body, and that's definitely scary as well.
Yeah. The incidences of ghosts wielding some kind of blade is very high in this game. That's been my experience.
Yeah, there's a character that looks like she's from Resident Evil 4, like one of the female villagers with a sickle.
Yep.
Yeah.
House that we encountered that ghost in, because that was from our stream, was filled with axes. Like every room had an axe.
Oh, yeah.
She shows up with a sickle.
Yeah, that's the one that got Jala. Like the only natural casualty of the night, as we were trying to take photographs of this appearance. I only say natural casualty because when we got to the school, I think it was, we were about to end the stream, and it's like, no, like we need to show what happens when you die, because
Cole's gotta die.
For ghost science, Cole has to die, because Jala got hit and said, oh gosh, this is really cool, like what happens when the ghost comes up and like holds their hand over your face and snaps your neck and stuff like that. Like it's actually pretty neat, and it's a bummer that because she wasn't streaming, the viewers didn't get to see it. So like we tried very, very hard to manufacture a situation where a ghost would come and kill me, and like I had to do everything short of like butter myself up and hop on a silver platter to get this thing to come and get me.
We had to be fair, it was a shade, right? Which is the most shy ghost.
Yes.
we had to do a take two.
I do think, like you said, I do think there's a lot of potential here, though. But yeah, there is also a lot of kind of weirdness to it still.
Mm-hmm. yeah the ghost itself, like animating like it walking and stuff like that, is a little clunky sometimes. How it appears and disappears, a little clunky sometimes. It's definitely something that will need polish, but
you said this is made by one person, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it's hard to be too upset, or anything about that. And it's like it's pre-release too, so it's like this isn't like a finished game, so I'm not going with those expectations. But it's definitely, I think, a lot for what it is so far. Or it's like it's done a good job of, it feels like a pretty well-rounded game for the fact that it's been made by one person.
It's a pretty incredible accomplishment.
I feel like one thing I do kind of wish it could get is a little bit of the like the Left 4 Dead like director
banter.
The banter too. But I was gonna say the director, because like there were definitely times where like there's one of the times where we had been there for a while, and you know, I had collected all the information we needed and was kind of getting down to time. And then so we're kind of packing up. And I'm like, oh, I didn't actually take a picture of the ghostwriting in the book. You get a bonus for that. And so, mm-hmm. like, I ran back in to do it. And, like, that would have been the time to trigger the Han. You know?
Yeah, just to recognize, like, all right, so identify that this is, you know, a situation that you created or that the group created, and this would be a high drama moment to really, like, crank the throttle.
I mean, plenty of games have that kind of game director AI, and I'm not going to say it's easy to do, but I'll say it's like a proven concept that I would love to see show up more.
Well, let me defend it a little bit. Like, there's been a handful of times where I'm walking towards the front door, it slams shut, and my flashlight starts blinking, and I'm like, oh shit, I got to find a room. It's random right now, but on the other side of it, I don't want them to do that like every time, right? They would just. Yeah, maybe some nudges would be good. But
I mean, and when we talk about, oh, it'd be cool if they did this or anything, like, we played, what, six rounds, something like that?
Yeah, five.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
And Ben, you've played many, many hours of it.
Yeah, what level are you now, Ben?
I'm like in the 50s or low 60s or high 50s, somewhere around there.
Yeah, and to be fair, I do know, like, again, I read the wiki a lot because that's apparently what I do for games. And, like, all of the ghosts have very explicit AI. So, you know, like, one of the most noteworthy ones is, I think it's the Banshee. Like, will pick at the start of the game one character, and no matter how many times the hunt triggers, they will only go after that character and ignore everyone else. And so, you know, until they get killed and then they pick someone else. So, like, with that, it then becomes a game of, like, you know, figuring out that that's what's happening and then figuring out who the target is.
And your job this round is to stay in the van.
Yeah. Or sit in the closet.
Yeah. It's like, okay, we need to draw them out for this, that, or the other. So guess what? Sacrificial lamb. Yeah. Nice.
I will say, someone pointed out in the Slack, because we played it on Discord comms, and I kind of assumed that the in-game voice chat would just be that you're always in, you know, the other person's ear. But come to find out, apparently it does model where voices are in the house.
It does, yeah.
And so what someone in the Slack said was that, you know, that some of the coolest moments can be someone just starts hollering and you're not sure what room they're in, or you're trying to hear what, you know, what place in the house they are. So
That's cool.
I'll be interested in, you know, if we play it again, if we have a more accommodatable number of people, I would love to try it with in-game voice chat.
Yes. Yeah. I think that we went for, so on one hand, we went for clarity, like, just, we know Discord is going to work. On the other hand, I don't know that in-game voice chat works for Ben.
Yeah. I was going to bring that up. I wasn't sure how it worked for people in general. Cause, like, there was a situation where we went to the Ouija board and no one else could get it to activate.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know, like, I haven't had that same problem with other people that I played with, so I don't know. It seems like finicky at times. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Especially the spirit box.
Yeah.
I do love that mechanic of, you know, pulling in the, I guess we haven't said, like, for a bunch of the, or a number of the things, the Ouija board and the spirit box, which is basically, you know, talking to the ghost. You have to actually over voice chat, ask questions, and the ghost will listen. You know, similarly, at least in theory, the ghost, you know, like, monitors your audio. And if you, like, repeatedly say its name, stuff like that, you can piss it off. So I really like that idea of, like, actually pulling in, you know, needing to actually say things and stuff like that. It's a really cool idea. It doesn't seem like it's quite where it needs to be yet, but.
Yeah.
I know they're specifically, or the person specifically working for patch 2 for Windows 7 as well. I know that's specifically a me problem, but.
Everybody in the chat was just agog that that you were still on Windows 7.
Yeah, let's not get into it.
No, it's fine. It's your choice. It's just weird.
Yeah.
Also, we haven't talked about the amazing character animation for when you're looking up.
It's really good. You bend over backwards at the waist like in Futurama when the professor got his spine alignment. Bender bent the professor's spine backwards, so he bent 90 degrees at the waist looking up, and he all of a sudden got a bright, sunny, optimistic attitude because he was always looking at the sky. Oh, it's so fun. Yeah
And the game's design, well, I guess you can play it either way, but it supports VR, so like a person walking around in VR looks much different than a person like walking around with the normal controls.
I'm real curious to try it in VR.
Yeah, I've only played it with one person that I know, and they said they got a little bit motion sick, but they had also just gotten a VR, so I don't know if it was VR in general or this game specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you can dual wield ghost hunting equipment in VR.
Hell yeah. Yeah, you can akimbo.
So walk in with the electromagnetic reader and the temperature. Get those two.
You walk in with two glow sticks and you beeline for the gym and have a rave.
Yes.
Boots and spats and boots and spats.
Oh man. Did we have any other things to say about Phasmophobia? I mean, all of us played it plus Jala, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those. I feel like it's one of those games that just has so many little quirks and things to notice in it. Like you could fill an episode with it for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much.
We haven't even gotten to basketball yet.
Yeah.
Well, you can talk about basketball if you want.
I mean, that the most important part of the game right there is the little hoop with a counter that's in the lobby. And the most frustrating part of the game so far is that while you can throw the ball through the hoop, you can't quite get any other object high enough to go through. Yeah. You literally get it to like bounce off the top of the rim, but I have not been able to make the shot with a paint can yet. So
have you played Dwarf Fortress?
I have.
Dwarf Fortress. I'm sorry.
Deep Rock Galactic.
Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, that was a weird.
No.
That's good guess.
Do they have something like that in the game?
Oh yeah, they have a
kick the can.
Yep, kick the can into the basketball hoop or whatever hoop.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah, but and it's all I think starts with Overwatch's basketball hoop in the starting ship.
I'll be happy to play this with you guys in the future. Also, Among Us as well. Either one.
Yeah, Among Us would be a fun one to do next time because that one at least our problem with Phasmophobia was that we were all talking instead of coordinating about what we were going to do. Among Us seems a little bit less demanding.
definitely am pro doing more of this co-op stuff, more of the streaming stuff because that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I only had one other thing on Friday night before the Phasmophobia stream. So the day before the Phasmophobia stream, I went back to one of the games in the DreadX collection too. And I wanted to finish that out because it was developed by the guy who made Dusk, Dave Szymanski. Dusk is a game I really enjoy. I also enjoyed his what he put into the DreadX collection 1. And what he put into DreadX Collection 2 is a game called Squirrel Stapler.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a horror game because everything in that collection is a horror game, but it is a horror hunting game. So the concept is it's you have gone out into the woods like on a little vacation with your wife, but your wife has died. You want her to be beautiful again. So you need to go and hunt squirrels and staple the squirrels to her so she can be beautiful again. And, it's over the course of 5 days, you wake up and most of the time your wife's body is, kind of like propped up in the corner of the room. You go outside. I say most of the time because she eventually starts wandering around and leaving notes for you and stuff. But the majority of the time spent in the game is out in this rather large wooded area with a rifle that bolt action rifle. You can only shoot once before you have to reload it. And you hold five bullets at a time and you're going out and shooting after squirrels. And it's, not easy because you have to be very sneaky to get up on those varmints. You know, they're going to run away. And you have to go ahead.
Not all of them are sure kills either.
Right. you know, you can miss because you have to shoot from pretty far away, oftentimes like hiding in low resolution foliage. But on the third day, they introduce what I was calling demon squirrels, but in the game, I guess they call them squirrel bears or something like that. These are massive squirrels that are bright red and will go on patrol around the area. They'll run up to you and blow up and kill you instantly. And they will either spot you, just visually, or whenever you fire your gun, they will start immediately moving in the direction to investigate wherever that was.
Oh, huh.
Yeah. So it immediately, it's the cliche, the hunter has become the hunted, but you over the course of trying to fulfill your objective are shooting and then moving away from where you took the shot as quickly as possible so that that thing can come in and like maybe hopefully you will go and claim the skin of the squirrel, you know, before you move on to go and look for the next one. And so it's incredibly tense.
A similar strategy in Among Us. You run away from the body as quickly as possible.
Yep.
To be fair, that tends to be an important, strategy for such things.
Yeah.
Question is, does the Dreadx collection I put it up online also apparently have a dating sim?
Yes. Yeah, that's in Dreadx Collection 2. I talked about it when I talked about Dreadx Collection 2. I forget what it's called. I literally forget the name of it. It's very good because like you summon a Cthulhu, an Eldritch Cthulhoid monster, and like it's you trying to make her happy by performing these rituals that will ultimately end the world, and it can end in a couple of different ways depending on how successfully you complete the rituals and, whether or not you decide to invoke the, the banishing spells and stuff like that to undo it. But I was really happy to go back and finish Squirrel Stapler because the ending of it's really, really fun. I don't want to spoil what is there. You can go and look at the stream if you're curious about it. But I did not expect it to do what it was going to do. But yeah, it is a really fun horror stealth game. It has the gun in it is really satisfying to fire, which is, a hallmark of this developer. And I'm real curious what they're going to be doing next.
This looks really fun.
Yeah, the Dreadx stuff is kind of weird. Like initially I very much wrote it off. But the more I've seen of it, the more it seems like there's actually I know, like not just like the generic horror stuff, but it seems like a bunch of them are actually very creative takes on horror.
It's extremely varied. Not everything is a straight putt. I mean, I just described a game where you hunt squirrels and staple them to your wife's body.
As you do.
Marriage stuff.
Well,
I'm watching a video of it, and it's a testament to, I know like the lo-fi look is kind of the thing for these, but just how fast that melts into the background once you're into the gameplay, or even watching someone get into the gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
The video starts like, oh, what is going on? Like this is, and then you just kind of forget about it as you play. So that's always been the magic of games, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you immediately go all the way into it. Yeah. So that's me. Let's see here. Ben, how about you?
Yeah, I also have one on top of Phasmophobia. I was able to beat Hades over the weekend.
Oh, cool. So you made your escape.
I made a escape. Yep. Got out of hell. I mean, the game's not bad. This is like a weird way to review it, but like, I feel like I have to give opinion on it in contrast to everyone saying it's like the best game ever, where it's like, I don't think that's true. I think it's right. Like not a bad game, but like I don't even know if it's the best game of this year. Like, I like Phasmophobia better than this game. You know, like,
yeah,
it's not bad, but it's not bad though. Like it. So I don't know. I put it in a weird position where I'm not trying to put like negatives on the game because it's a good experience, but
people get really exuberant about new toys. I don't say that to diminish their enthusiasm, because it's cool and fun when you find a game that you really, really enjoy. It's just, it's something that, you know, we run into quite a bit where it's like, yeah, the expectation game on this is kind of strange, actually.
The strength of the game, or the thing that the game does that other games don't do, is the fact that it has a whole bunch of dialogue to it. And like, and so like, that's like the unique feature of the game. The roguelite part of it is like, it's one of the first roguelite games that I've played, so it's that mechanic's like new-ish to me. But even that, like, I don't know, there's like an interesting like pluses and minuses to that. Like, on the one side, I kind of like the idea of a game rewarding people for working hard at it for a long time instead of like being skilled like really well at it.
Yeah.
Because I think that's like a valuable lesson to learn in terms of like life or whatever. But at the same time, I also feel like it's kind of cheap that, like, you're tremendously disadvantaged at the beginning of the game compared to the end of the game, or it's like, yeah, you're not likely going... It feels almost like an artificial gate, where it's like... Or if it's like... It's, you know, and this is kind of like this with any game. It's like, every game you're going to start weak and end strong, you know what I mean? But it's like... And so, with every game, there's kind of this, like, artificiality where it's like they're nerfing you at the beginning, you know, so that you can evolve into, like... it being like a good experience or a competent gameplay. I don't even know what I'm getting at here, but
so we contrast that, because you said you hadn't really played a roguelike before, and I was like, we Slay the Spire, man.
Dead Cells.
So contrast that to games like those.
Slay the Spire is not like that though. Slay the Spire unlocks new cards that you can get, but the new cards that you get aren't necessarily like strictly upgrades to the original cards that you have. And the other part too is, if you do the Ascension on Slay the Spire, it's the reverse, where the game gets harder and harder as you go on, not easier and easier.
Not very fair.
I don't know. Slay the Spire is awesome. How dare you talk about Slay the Spire? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. How people are talking about this game is kind of how I feel about Slay the Spire.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's different approaches to roguelites, whether it's going to be, you know, rely entirely on developing player skill versus avatar skill, right?
Yeah, and the other thing, I'm not really sure how well I've, like, quote-unquote mastered the game, because I've only ever used the one weapon. I talked to some people about this over the week, and they were, like, aghast. They're like, oh, yeah, you got to use, like, all the different weapons. But it's like, I wasn't really interested in using the ranged weapons that you can unlock.
Okay, so I feel so much better, because I think so far the sword is the only weapon I actually like.
Yeah.
I don't know, the bow in particular feels way too slow to me, and the shield kind of does as well, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, maybe I just need to play around with this more and kind of be open to it. But, like, another weird thing about the experience, too, is it feels like the different upgrades, the boons that you can get from the different gods, aren't at parity with one another. And it's like, so you could just happen to have a run where you just, the god that keeps appearing is, what's his name? Dionysus, the party god or whatever.
Oh, yeah,
Dionysus, like, Bacchus. Yeah.
Dionysus, my namesake? Come on, man.
His buffs, I do not think, are too great. whereas like Zeus's buffs I think are strong, the Doom one is really strong, the Freeze one I think is really strong as well, the Freeze God. So there's kind of like a little bit of a cheapness there too, where it feels like sometimes you, because it seems like when you go on a run you kind of have a pool of like three or four gods that will appear more frequently, and like you just won't see certain gods in a given run. And so it feels like sometimes it's just like luck of the draw, where it's like, well, I just got like three or four crappy gods that I don't really enjoy playing with those upgrades. So it's like, what am I going to do? Yeah. There is like one mechanic you can upgrade where you can like re-roll what the awards are for the next room. So they try and mitigate that a little bit. But that's one thing that feels more of like a cheapness in this game than other games like Slay the Spire or something else, where, where it feels like sometimes you can kind of get pigeonholed, where it's like, well, even if you play really well, you're kind of stuck in this, like, you're not going to get like a runaway like upgrade system and with this pool of gods that you're going to get.
Yeah. Or, you know, like just playing Binding of Isaac, where you're just not going to get the treasure rooms that you want. You know, sometimes you just get, you know, you figure out early on that you're not going to get the, you know, the items that you need in order to make it to the end. And you have to decide whether to bail from the run or see if you can make the most of it.
Yeah, I'll
argue in favor of that kind of design, though, because it heightens the sense that something special is happening when the gods do align, literally in the case of Hades.
I mean, so the thing I don't like about it is I feel like I'm not in control of it at all. Like with Slay the Spire, I think it's really good because usually there's like so many options that if you're playing like optimally, it doesn't matter if you have like a lot of bad options. If you can see like what cards work really well, even if it's like a strategy you haven't tried before, you can like push yourself in a direction that'll make a really competent deck. Whereas like here, I don't feel like you have as much autonomy. Like you just are given like, oh, here's like, you know, three things. None of them are going to help you, but you have to pick one of them. So
yeah,
you can, like, the strategy is like forced for you, because the strategy in this one is like, it's typically you get a lot of boons from the same god because they'll reinforce one another. There's also some boons that are like pairings where it's like, oh, you have boons from both these people. This one will be a combination of both their abilities, which is cool when that happens. But again, since you don't have control over like the gods that appear, it feels like you're being forced into a certain strategy instead of choosing and like pushing yourself into a strategy you want to go into.
Although, isn't that kind of like the core of a roguelike thing, or am I wrong?
Yeah, I was gonna say, I like, at least in Slay the Spire, to kind of segue over a little bit, there's, you know, there's kind of like one or two builds that I know are capable of, you know, beating the game.
Mm-hmm.
And if I, you know, even if I'm not really getting the tools offered to me, even if I'm, you know, even if I'm getting offered more tools for a different kind of build, I know those, you know, everything other than that one build that I know is really strong for that character, I don't think is going to get me through the end game. And so I kind of always wind up creating just the closest approximation of the build that I can get to.
Because a
well-crafted, you know, version of a subpar build is going to lose out to a approximation of a really strong build.
So, yeah. Oh, actually, I'm not sure. Maybe we're saying the same thing, or maybe you're saying different things. Because that's
what I'm saying. So that's different than what you're describing in Hades, where kind of, well, it all depends on how viable weird combinations are in Hades, I guess.
Well, so the thing that I'm saying is, like, one, you're limited in the number of combinations you have because it kind of puts you down routes of what you can pick. Comparatively, I hopefully we don't talk in circles here forever, but like, with like, there's a similar mechanic in like Magic card drafting that there is in Slay the Spire, where you have to like kind of see what's open. That's more so in Magic than in Slay the Spire. It's like not as much like reading signs of things wheeling or whatever. But there's like in Slay the Spire, there's like at least four or five different ways for each character to like win the game. There's like four or five different like deck archetypes that they can build towards. I'm thinking of Ironclad in particular. There's like strength run. There's like a status run. There's maybe a high defense run. That sort of thing. And so you know, the game is kind of like picking artifacts and like picking cards to try and build towards one of those pathways, you know. But you can just make random decks that just happen to work, that happen to have weird synergies. In Hades, it doesn't feel like you can do any of that sort of thing. Like, certainly the boons will reinforce one another. So for example, like lightning, you'll get one where it's like your weapon deals lightning damage. You'll get another one later that's like when you deal lightning damage, it gives them jolting where they're like stun other enemies after they attack. And so you could do things like that build on top of one another. But the problem is that like, that's like a predefined strategy that they have with a single god. And like, when you're doing a run, you're probably going to see that god multiple times and like just pick those, you know, to reinforce your own strategy. And maybe you might have a second or tertiary god that you have as well, but there's like a pool of maybe like, I don't know, I guess like 10 or 12 different gods that you can choose from. There isn't as much like interaction as far as like, oh, I'm going to take this god's mechanic. Oh, and then this other god has this mechanic, and these two work really, really well together. Like, there's not as much of that going on, which is unfortunate.
So what you're saying is this game is really big into monotheism.
not sure how to describe that. I don't know. Yeah, you pick your god and you go with that. You go heavily on that. So maybe it's like world religions. So
I feel like for me, my favorite thing I've gotten so far, which I don't think's actually effective, but I like it, is which deity is it that gives you the ability to like deflect projectiles?
It starts with an A, but I forget. I know you're talking about
Apollo.
I know who you're talking about, though.
Yeah, like, I know. I find that really satisfying. The problem is, I know, I don't find it that useful, especially because your regular attack will just, like, destroy projectiles.
It's Athena, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true. There are places where it's helpful. Even within that strategy, like, some of them don't seem as useful as others. Like, because you can get like deflection when you dash, you can get deflection when you take damage, or you can get deflection in like your special or regular attack. There's definitely places where the deflection is like really powerful. Like, for example, if someone's like shooting a bunch of projectiles and you just deflect on top of them and all of those get redirected back to them, like you can like kill like Meg like really quickly with that type of thing. So that can be really satisfying. But yeah, I don't know. The game's weird. It doesn't seem as like, I don't want to shit on this game too much. I enjoyed playing this game and I like this game. I just think that some of the design and like how you upgrade things, it just feels kind of random and you don't have as much authority over like building your awesome build by the end of the deck. A lot of times it feels like you randomly get a really good one, but a lot of times it feels like you can't choose that.
Yeah.
Well, and there too, you know, people will come to a game looking for different levels of involvement on each of the levels of play, right? So some people are going to want to have really high control over the build and want to like really think through and strategize that. Other people are just going to want to focus on the action and the build is nice perks on top of it and all that. So, you know, to some extent, it could just be they chose to put their time and intent into other places.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on Hades?
No, I'm pretty much done talking about it and playing it. It's good. I mean, I'll buy and play whatever the next game they make is too. But
I'll wait for my pitchfork for the pitchfork carrying crowd to arrive at my house.
I mean, it's worthwhile. You know, you shouldn't be afraid to criticize a game just because a bunch of people, you know, are really fawning over it. Like, you know, like we're still relatively, you know, soon after, you know, it's the game released relatively recently, right? And there's still kind of a honeymoon period with it. There's probably going to be a backlash at some point, but like that should not determine the bounds of what you are able to say about it. I think that people listening would welcome a thoughtful critique of it, or, you know, kind of an explanation for why, as somebody who enjoys one kind of rogue-like-ish kind of game, you know, just how it stacks up against that kind you prefer.
Yeah. What roguelike do you like? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you shouldn't be afraid of it, but it still might be in your best interest.
Whatever. Yeah. And don't nobody yell at Ben for being mildly critical of Hades.
That's right. You literally say like Cole at duckfeed.tv.
That would be a really weird thing to do. Dennis.
Yeah. So I've been playing more Slay the Spire. It's still in that place for me where I'm at Ascension level 6 now, I think, with my highest character. And so runs just take a lot of focus and thought and all that stuff, because the way you build your deck is a very important part of this. So it's, you know, still going on. Not a lot new to say on that. However, I did pick up a deck building roguelike game called Nowhere Prophet.
Can I say one thing about Slay the Spire real quick?
Oh, sure.
Not every run can be a winner. Sometimes you just gotta pull off the band-aid and die on a run to start a new one.
It's happened like more often.
Yeah.
but that's the thing though, is what I feel incentivized to do is, you know, start the first three rounds of a run, or three bad guys levels of a run, I guess, just until I get one that has the perfect alignment with whatever deck I have in mind that I want. At which point I'm not really doing the roguelike thing. I'm just having a very inefficient character creation. You know? So,
I mean, how does that compare to, isn't like very inefficient character creation kind of the tagline for Players Unknown's Battleground? And I mean, they've been successful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and at that point, you know, if that's what's rubbing me the wrong way, I should just play on the first Ascension level. Like, I don't need to be holding my hand on that stove. So, I'm a bit complaining that I can't have my cake and eat it as well. And the answer is you just need to get better at the game, and then you can win more consistently.
So you're saying you need to get good?
Yeah, that's,
we don't say that here.
So, Nowhere Prophet is a deck builder that shares a lot in common with Slay the Spire. I can't speak to how much it shares in common with Monster Train, although I think they're all kind of in that same genre together. But I played through my first run of Nowhere Prophet this week and loved it. So the story of the game is like a post-apocalyptic society. You witness a satellite falling out of the sky and travel to like see the crash site. And the satellite actually like communicates with you, gives you information, and that suddenly turns you, like everyone who's there sees it happen, and they're now all following you to this promised land that the satellite has told you about through the wastes, as it were. And so these followers become your deck of cards. Hmm. And every follower has special abilities. So in a given conflict, it very much follows the convention of playing versus another player, which is where it differs from Slay the Spire. So you're playing against another hero or villain, I guess, in this case, that has a deck. And I imagine eventually you'll kind of be able to anticipate, oh, this is the armor focused hero, or this is the rushdown focused hero, and kind of plan your strategy accordingly. But before each battle, you kind of decide what followers to have in your deck. Every follower's got special abilities, and is a card that you play out into the board. The board in this game, instead of just being a row of people like it is in a lot of other card battler games, is a grid, usually like 3x4 or some variant thereof, and certain spots will be taken up by different terrain obstacles. Hmm. Only the furthest forward person in each row is able to attack. And so there's kind of a dimension of strategy to where you play people, because you want, you know, if you want to attack someone, they got to be in front. However, if someone has like a passive ability that you more want to just make sure they're safe ongoing, you want to put them in the back. And instead of attacking on any given round, you can also move them to a different place in the grid. And so there's a lot more to do once a character is played out than I've seen in other games. And I really, really like that aspect of it. And it's in that stage of kind of learning the dialect of the play for this game, where I'm just having realizations every single time I play around of like, oh, I could have done that better. Or, oh, okay, now I get why this card is good. And that's like the really fun part of any card game like this, is finding and starting to learn how to use those synergies.
Mm-hmm.
The grid layout reminds me of like Stratego for some reason.
Yeah, actually, that's not bad at all. because there's also like, you know, you can only attack the foremost person in each row. And, you know, certain enemies will cover for each other and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. On top of that, on the kind of higher layer of the game, losing your units in a battle matters. So generally, In card games like this, you know, you kind of play out your early units expecting you're going to trade them away. And you know, any unit that you play out, you know, could be expressly knowing that it's going to die for some greater strategic benefit. And that's certainly the case here during rounds. Like, that's just a part of the nature of the game. However, when one of your units dies, they become wounded, which means that they lose one health and they start damaged by one. And their cost, mana-wise, goes down. That actually can make the card more powerful in a lot of circumstances. So the next time you play them, you know, you can get them out. They've lost one health, but generally, like, being one mana cheaper is more valuable than having one less health, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so these units, these wounded units, are kind of more powerful, especially because some cards that you can pick up synergize around damaged units. However, if they die a second time after being played wounded, you will lose them permanently.
Mm.
And that is a really interesting way to go, because your, you know, your followers, your pool of cards is probably 40 people at any given point, and it grows from there. And you only need 20 some odd cards to build your deck. So you're going to have extras. But it's that push and pull of like, all right, this card fits perfectly into the idea behind my deck right now. And it's really powerful right now because it's wounded, but that puts me in danger of losing it permanently. And if I, you know, if I lose this card, then I got to completely reinvent my build. But if I'm not using that card, like, why have it in my build in the first place? And like the tension there is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Layer on top of that the fact that the card that deals, or the follower that deals the killing blow in any given combat is considered blessed, and their attack goes up by one. And it doesn't stack, so they're either blessed or not, you know, have one attack or not. But if they're wounded and they win the combat for you or deal the killing blow, they are cured of their wounds as well.
Oh, so and high risk, high reward.
Yes.
Wait. Okay. Do they go back to their pre-wounded status of like having one more health and mm-hmm. cost one more?
So their health and cost go back up, and they become blessed.
Okay.
Which I almost hear the gears turning, right? Sometimes that means that you specifically don't want to deal the killing blow with a wounded soldier if you're like, yeah, it's more valuable for it to have them hurt, you know? They play better hungry.
You know. I'm just imagining the real life situation of you like being bop, 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 bop. They're like, hold down your garment. This guy is going to shoot him.
Well, you know, they know their place as a grunt. They're more disposable. They are, you know, they're more scrappy. So like that is just such a really, really cool set of interplaying systems that will change your decisions on the micro battle and on the macro layer. And that's all just with the combat related and deck building stuff. That is all really, really cool. On top of that, there are Slay the Spire kind of non-combat events as you make your way across the desert. And what's really neat is every single follower gets a name, they XCOM it, you know, which is, you know, you get attached to them or you recognize them, or you're like, oh, that's like the guy that's in my deck that I use all the time.
Do they Last of Us Part Two it? Do people scream out their names when they die?
No, not quite. But they will put you in situations where a specific follower will be connected to a special option. And it's like, okay, you know, you think there is food, you know, in this abandoned building. You can all go and forge for it, or you can send so-and-so who's, you know, got some special night vision goggles or whatever to look for it. And it's like kind of putting them in danger for a greater result. That's a bad example. It doesn't quite work that way. But, you know, you're trying to infiltrate a camp, and you can either assault the camp straight up, or you can send one of your followers to scout it. That's probably a better example. And so like you're putting that specific card in danger, or there's options that are unlocked, but it's like, you know, the guard of the city that you're visiting wants to recruit so-and-so. They'll give you free passage through the city if you, you know, allow you let go this person. And so it's just a really interesting twist to the decision making, because it's, you, at least that I saw, you don't quite get direct control of the followers that are added. You know, people will flock to you and you can kind of choose the best out of them to include in your deck, but it's not Slay the Spire style where you're specifically selecting which ones you want. However, very frequently you'll be asked, hey, like this specific guy, you can get something nice if you let them go. Are you willing? And that's an interesting decision.
So this is basically the world where you show up to church and they're like, but how are you in a fight?
Yeah. Well, there's three tracks you can advance. There's scholar, believer, and altruist. And certain decisions that you make certainly are on the church front. Some are on like the, you know, the quest for learning more about the satellites front. And then there's, you know, just helping people in need. And it's very post-apocalyptic in terms of like there's people that are enslaved. And even the thing that got me was I was going between cities, and every time you move to a new encounter, it costs food and it costs hope. And I was running out of food. I didn't have any food left. I didn't know what was going to happen, because the next time I move, I'm going to try to do it on zero food. I don't know if people start dying or what. And this caravan comes by and says like, oh, we recognize that guy. he belongs to us. That's one of our slaves, escaped slaves.
Hmm.
And I had the choice, and like, we will pay you handsomely for returning him to us, reward you, you know, well. And I sold out this single follower, so I had food for everyone else. It was just like a really teeth grinding, heartbreaking thing to do. It was like I had to dismiss. It's just a game. It's just a game. But doing that locked me permanently out of the altruist track.
Right, because you cooperated with a slaver.
Right, so you cooperate with a slaver once, and you're completely locked out of all future growth as an altruist or any points you can put into the altruist track
in this run.
Yeah. Okay. And so it was interesting though, because it carried weight in that, like, I didn't, this first run was magical because like I truly didn't know what the stakes were, or what was happening, or exactly what was going on. Now that I've finished it once, you know, you kind of come to it with a bit more knowledge. But to have that consequence hit and like to really feel the weight of it, it's like, well, I can feed my people now, but even the ending text where it's like, oh, you know, you successfully figured out what's going on with the satellites and the robots, and you're starting a new society, but you make sure to clearly educate the robots on who's important and who's a slave. And I was like, oh God.
Oh boy.
Fuck that.
If only Jarrett was here to see this.
Exactly. Like, it twists that knife pretty hard. But yeah, I was still able to pull off a win despite that decision. And I like that it felt like the choices were consequential. So
that sounds cool. It sounds cool making people out of the cards that would be in Slay the Spire. You know what I mean? There's like a lot more story depth there then.
Exactly. Yeah. So that combined with the grid-based combat, combined with the kind of macro story choices that you make, is really interesting. Oh, I mean, I haven't even touched on one of the other points, which is you're actually playing two decks of cards at once. So yeah, contrast to Deck of Wonders, right, where both sides are one deck. In this one, each side has two decks. So you have a deck of your followers. You also have a deck of leadership cards. In each turn, you draw a leadership card and you draw a follower card. And the leadership cards are essentially your spells, right? They have immediate impact. But you will, you know, as you travel, you'll pick up gear, and you can either equip gear for a passive bonus, or equip a tool for an active bonus that's not tied to a card. So it's like the hero power in Hearthstone. Or you can dismantle that gear, which means you permanently lose access to that, you know, tool or gear, but you get a new leader card. And you can manage like the number of leader cards in your deck and customize your leader deck in that way. So there's a lot going on in this game. And after I won my first run, I unlocked all the other classes. So I just played through the base starter class. There's a lot to be excited about in Nowhere Prophet, and I'm excited to keep on playing it. This is one I would really be interested to see you play, or to play with you.
I was gonna say I would be interested to see you play so I can kind of get a base level of like what all's going on. I'm looking at it.
Tell you everything that's going that you're doing wrong.
No. I have no bank of knowledge on this game like I do.
Sure. Yeah.
I have a shallow reaction and kind of a little bit of, you know, less shallow one, which is I love the visual style on this, like the hand drawn like graphic. Comic kind of look to the characters, like, and things.
Yeah, paper cutouts is almost like the feel of it a bit.
Yeah.
Not in texture, but just in the way that the colors, and like there's not really outlines on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's just super just graphic is the only word that I can think to use, like from like a design sense.
It looks like a cross between Borderlands and This Is the Police.
Yeah, This Is the Police is a good touch on it as well. This is a cool metaphor, and I think that it goes a very long way towards like justifying a structure of this kind of game, where like you're making a choice of like which kind of battle which kind of encounter you're going to go for, but like by putting that on a map of nodes that you are progressing along in order to get, you know, to the satellite, I think that that is like a really satisfying and like understandable version of this. That I dig. It's a good functional metaphor.
Cooler. Oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I mean, that looks one to one with Slay the Spire.
Mm-hmm. Well, even cooler in this is there will be the path of the map. There will be certain branches that you can't see the end of. So there's like the main, you can always see one or two main arteries all the way to your objective. But then there's other thing where it's like, ooh, there's a cathedral on the ridge over there. It looks like it's highlighted as something that's rich in resources, but you could get there and then see that you have to go through like three difficult battles in a row you don't know until you get there, which is really
there cool. Is there a way to back out? Like, can you spend mm-hmm. resources mm-hmm. to go? Okay.
You can. So you can actually move backwards and sideways along the trail. It just costs more food and hope every time you move.
Gotcha.
I like hope.
But it's dispiriting. Yeah. It's dispiriting to, admit defeat.
Yeah, well, to back up or to feel like you're wandering around in the desert. But there was specifically one place where we called
it the 2020 effect.
Yeah. there was one place where I did kind of go sideways and back a little bit just so I could hit a resource rich node. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was interesting to plan that out, because now that I think about it, later on in that trip was when I ran out of food. There's all that. There's the gear. There's different like types of followers. There is a really delightful amount of depth to this game.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's Nowhere Prophet.
Looks cool. I had never heard of this before. How did this get on your radar?
I actually think I found it before I found Slay the Spire, and I think it's probably the Steam algorithm was like, hey, you like deck builders? This is that.
Okay, yeah.
And that's where it first came on my radar.
Nice.
My final thing is I've been playing more Star Wars Squadrons. The game continues to be awesome. Right now, the meta is bombers, specifically the Empire's bombers, which they've discovered that if you just literally fly in a straight line towards the capital ship, ignore everything else in the game and fire, like generally people can't kill you fast enough to stop you from winning, or even if they do, you've just done a ton of damage to their capital ship and like... So it's like some match.
It's a kamikaze strategy.
It really, it's very Empire.
Yeah.
But it's not very fun because you get, especially in pub matches where you're in with randos. It's like, okay, first off, I got chosen to be the Alliance side. So that's a mark against it first. And then I see, oh, look, the other side is spawning with three bombers. I know exactly how this game is going to play out. So that's 10 minutes of my life.
Like another thing that I've heard about is bombers, again, specifically TIE bombers, which are universally overpowered, stalling out, kind of either moving very slow or just staying still and basically being like a rotating turret. And as long as you can, look around and shoot stuff quick enough, you can deal with most threats that are going to come in and mess you up.
So. Yeah, you will win all jousts, and honestly, even if you get surprised, they won't have enough damage to kill you in one pass. So TIE bombers are going to get nerfed for sure, and be healthier because of it. Some people have been saying like, oh, just switch to ion weapons, and that shuts them down real quick. And there's, I think, if you're in a coordinated team, there are tools to do that.
Yeah.
And I think if the game gets to a place like a League of Legends is, where like everyone jumps in knowing kind of their role, and there's a very codified way to approach the game, maybe it wouldn't be as much of a problem. But right now this lives way closer to like a first person shooter deathmatch multiplayer feel, where everyone's just kind of jumping in with whatever they like to use and having fun, and just one class is overpowered.
See, I'd love to see them approach this by adding some matches that were in atmosphere, where if you stall out, you just fall to your death.
That would be cool. That would be really cool.
I like the idea of like people being like, oh, there's a fix for this. Just fly in Y-wings, and everyone just being like, nah, that's okay.
No, the Alliance bomber is objectively worse. They don't deal as much damage. They die easier.
Can you fly in a B-wing in the game?
Unfortunately, no.
That's my favorite ship. Yeah. That was my favorite back in the day. I'm sure there's DLC headed towards this game. Oh, like there will be a special edition launch for next generations and.
No.
I'm kind of disappointed. I didn't know that was called a B-Wing, especially since it is blatantly a T. But yeah, those are the coolest ship.
It's a silent.
I don't know that I. Wow. I just weirdly found myself in the company of other people who really like the B-Wing.
Like, it's, yeah, apparently it's the best choice. Yeah.
It, the B stands for break in design with all the other ships. I don't know what the fuck they were doing, but it's awesome.
Yeah. B stands for best.
It's just it's the ship that you saw like in one shot in Return of the Jedi, and they like it never actually showed up in combat in the fight at Endor because the actual design was too thin to show up against the blue screen. So yeah, like it's just this weird, implausible, like crazy futuristic design that just kind of seems mysterious. Like in X-Wing, it's actually like a really good, like it is like a faster bomber. Like it is like specifically a bomber that is meant to like shut down multiple targets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, rotating cockpit for maneuverability. Mm-hmm. Just
yeah.
Give me some of that.
I just really want to see some game or Star Wars, franchise recognize the fact that TIE fighters could not operate in an atmosphere. Like, they would flip over.
Oh, you know.
I just want to throw out my one piece of B-Wing trivia of Star Wars is that Admiral Akbar flew in one.
No.
Nice.
This is... Yeah. He's a hero.
Seems fishy.
Yeah, I'm bummed out. I've not been able to put any more time into Star Wars Squadrons. I'm happy that you did, and also that the people that I'm reading talk about it on Twitter are not lying about how the the TIE bomber's OP.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have anything else about Star Wars Squadrons?
No, that's that is everything for me.
Cool.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where we ask you a question and then you answer it. Dennis, what did you ask the nice people?
Yeah, we're feeling spoopy this week here with Halloween. So I asked about spooks that stuck with you. So, you know, there's games that give you a jump scare in the moment. But what is the horror game that kind of followed you around afterwards?
So let's jump right in here and read Martinus, who says, PT really messed me up for a good while. That has got to be the spookiest game I have ever played, and to think it was only 45 minutes to an hour. It always makes me sad thinking about what could have been if only Silent Hills had been given a shot at life. And now I'll sit over here being sad.
You know what makes it feel worse? It was canceled because Konami wanted to make it into a slot machine instead of a video game company, and they couldn't coexist.
Oh no.
So sad.
How does that feel? All right.
Just for that, I'm going to have you read Callum's. What does Callum say?
Callum says, what I find hard to deal with in horror movies is the tension. And the recent Resident Evil 2 remake is the only game I have personally played that captures that with the way aiming and shooting feels with the zombies. Being stalked by Mr. X does not help. I recall the fog in the original Silent Hill having a similar but lesser effect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The fog in the streets that are as wide as they are long.
Yeah, it's the streets that are 17 lanes wide. Yeah. David.
Affluent. That's Silent Hill.
David, what does Christopher say?
Christopher says, Soma, Soma, Soma. I'm sure that's was the reading he was intending. There has never been any other game that is pure fuel for keeping me awake at night while I'm already contemplating my mortality.
Yeah. Existential horror, baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dennis, what does Steven say?
Steven says, RE4, when you first enter the village and everyone comes after you, then you get chased by the chainsaw guy. Stressed me out so bad the first time that I had to take a 2-month break from the game. Yeah, that is a hell of an opening.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. I want to go back and play that game again, because I actually didn't get much past that. And, like, at least up to that segment of the game, very much to me makes the case for like RE4 being a straight horror game as opposed to like the precursor of Resident Evil 5 and 6, And I'm interested to see if the rest of the game kind of makes a less sudden lead-in to what Resident Evil became.
And I mean, it changes. The opening is vastly different in tone than the closing.
Yeah, there's like a lot of points of like horror set pieces in the game, but it is very much like an action-y game.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Resident Evil 5's opening was kind of a callback to 4, right? Where you had kind of the chased by the villain, and then Chainsaw Guy came after you.
You're like in a town square, and there's
it's like
I don't know what to describe. It's like a Royal Rumble situation, right? Where you're like locked in with bad guys for like 5 minutes.
I mean, so like it's specifically the beginning of RE4 with those specific touch points that are laid out. You know, you got a chainsaw guy coming. That's not a chainsaw guy. It's an executioner with a gigantic axe in this one. Similar, you know, still a heavy enemy with a scary weapon. It's that mixed with Black Hawk Down is what they are calling to. Their referent for it. Yeah.
It is like nowhere near as effective, I feel like, as RE4 though.
Yeah.
Black Hawk Down.
The environment's not as interesting to explore, and there's not as much of a buildup, I don't think.
Agreed.
Yeah, I do feel like the segments where you have to like boost your teammate up, and then after a bit, like people come for whoever gets left behind, like those are fairly effective.
Let's see here. Elliot writes, Resident Evil 2. One weekend, when I was about 10 years old, my brother brought this home as a rental from the video shop for our N64. I'd stay up all night watching him play. The next weekend, I hired it out, only to find that I was too scared to play alone. It soon became a pattern of me renting it and hoping my brother would have the time to play so I could watch from the back seat. That still image of the zombie taken from the FMV on Resident Evil was burned into my brain when I tried to sleep at night. All I could hear were the moans of Raccoon City zombies. Good times. Honorable spooky mention goes to IG-88 in the junkyard from Shadows of the Empire. Goddamn, that was scary.
He's going with that over the underwater monster at the end of the game. I'm impressed by that.
I only have a vague recollection of what the IG-88 is.
It's the like robot. I guess he's in the new Star Wars series on Disney or whatever. But he's like the robot. I don't know, the skinny tall robot.
A robot with a Q-tip.
Huh.
That's a good way to describe it. Yeah.
Let's see, Ben. What does Mike say?
I said Resident Evil 4 is a wild, wild ride that has a ton of frightening and thrilling moments. However, it's after the game ends that it really gets under your skin. As the closing credits roll, we see what appear to be drawn pictures of life in the village. Soon a mysterious visitor appears, and we see crude artistic renditions of how all those lives of innocent men, women, and children were destroyed by Las Plagas. It's one of the most haunting things I've ever encountered in a video game. And it's the perfect sobering note to leave on for such a masterpiece of pacing and mood.
Thank you very much for talking about that, because people don't usually mention the credits. The credits
That's a really nice tribute to the game as well.
Yeah. David, what does Adam say?
Adam says, the naked Raiden part in Metal Gear Solid 2. It is kind of scary with your codec calling constantly. To the point where you have to ignore it. And they say strange things. I remember when they told me to turn the game console off, I did. It didn't seem too stupid considering the previous game asked you to plug the controller into port 2 to beat a boss.
I mean, and when you get into the codec, like, you can start seeing the people's skulls through their skin and stuff. Like, it's a real breakdown in reality, and you have no idea why this is happening or if it is another Psycho Mantis kind of thing. It's really also effective.
Apparently Raiden is naked, so that would be fairly terrifying.
He just runs around cradling his junk. It's fine. Yeah. Let's see here. Dennis, what does Greg say?
Greg says, the original System Shock. As a rule, I don't play scary games because they, well, scare me too much. But that game was so good that I was determined to finish it, even if I had to play in half-hour chunks during broad daylight.
Nice.
Yeah, setting for scary games is very important in terms of your physical setting where you play it.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Let's see here. Tom writes, I love Amnesia. Dark Descent suggests you play in the dark with headphones. I was happy to do so. I didn't know the tricks and paths, so I got to play a game alone and lost in the dark. I had not been diagnosed with anxiety at the time, but a lot makes sense now. And then I played Justine. Justine is a piece of DLC that was released a year later as part of the run-up to the release of Portal 2. Like, you are going through like little torture test chambers with a voice of a woman talking to you over the phonographs that you find. I'm just adding that context here. And then I played Justine, which gave you more lighting, but also gave you a pursuer following you. The brightly lit horror made sure to make me feel unsafe, even if all the lights were on. Yes. And Justine has also compounded the anxiety there because there's no saving. So if you die, you have to start over from the beginning.
So I think I might have misheard you. Did you say the run up to Portal 2, or did you mean Amnesia 2?
Portal 2.
Oh.
Yeah, in 2011. Amnesia, the Dark Descent came out in 2010. And in the run up to Portal 2, they put out this Portal inspired DLC that's actually pretty good.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just, I know where you're getting tripped up. Yes, Portal 2 came out 9 years ago. Yeah. Let's see, Ben, what does Skylar say?
Skylar says, weirdly enough, Metroid Fusion. I was a pretty young when it came out, and for all its flaws, the feeling of being stalked and hunted by the Sax kept up with me for quite a while. The first scene when Sax comes in and the camera zooms in over the visor really got me. It's probably the most horror possible to ring out of a Game Boy Advance.
Yeah. SAX. So in the lead up to the game, Samus gets infected by a kind of like alien parasite, and they have to remove her suit from her because it got like fused to her skin or something like that. And the parasite starts piloting her suit around and hunting you. It has all the SAX has all of your endgame abilities from Super Metroid, I believe. And you have to go through the entire, Metroid power up curve, before you're ultimately able to fight SAX.
Luckily, this was the last time that, Samus had to jettison her suit for weird plot points.
I mean, there was also the Metroid Prime series that came out after this. Yeah. let's see here. Who read that one? That was you, Ben. David, what does Ollie say?
Ollie says, the noises from Resident Evil still sometimes pop into my head and give me little shivers. You know the main one that sounds like water rivulets on glass steel? but to give a non-Resi answer, there is a first-person shooter called Fear. That was one of the first games I played with random vision showing up. It was a creepy kid telling you and your squad to do bad stuff.
Uh-huh.
Very creepy and effective. The shooting is dog shit, though. Oh, I love the shooting and Fear.
I remember Fear specifically for the ways it did not scare, meaning that like I would go into a dark room and be like, oh, there's a jump scare here, and it would just never come, and like you spend so much of the game in that tense position waiting for I think it's Alma, the little girl in it, to jump at you or to do something, and it's, by comparison, when she actually shows up is fairly few and far between,
right,
to where you expect to see her, which is the mark of a well-paced horror game, I think.
Yeah, I'm about to spoiler a several decades old game, but the ending of that game is, I'm trying to think, maybe my favorite ending of any video game.
Does it end with like the girl being on a helicopter or something?
Yeah, you basically evacuate out on a helicopter, and there's like a thump. And your characters are just kind of, what was that sort of thing? And she just like starts to crawl up over the side of the helicopter and it cuts to black. It's really, really effectively done instance of, like, you know, kind of the cliffhanger ending type of thing.
Yeah, you thought you dealt with
her, but... I don't think it's cliffhanger. I think you know exactly what happens. It's just a...
you thought that you had dealt with her, but, you know, this is it's Jason's hand bursting out of the water, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's also they also do a neat thing where, like, the first, I'd say, like, 4/5 of the game is you basically having jump scares with ghost armor, mm-hmm. and then the last 1/5 of the game is you having jump scares with, like, the actual physical armor that's basically the same character except now an adult.
Ooh. Yeah, I forgot about that. Most of my memories from that game are from the first part. Let's see. I believe this will be you, Dennis. What does Dan say?
Yep. Dan says Ollie coined the two I had in mind, but for another example, Alien Isolation is always a tense play due to the ingenious and unpredictable AI. God, I hate that Xenomorph.
I find it more frustrating than scary. I'm sorry. I don't mean to shit on your thing. I don't. Yeah, but it's
on the normal difficulty or the easy difficulty?
Both. Oh. Yeah. Don't punish me with instant death is ultimately what I'm coming down to.
Yeah, there's a lot of instant death in the normal difficulty.
Yeah. But I can see how. I mean, it is the kind of thing that would that does wear on you as you go, for sure, make you paranoid at the very least. Let's see. Patrick writes, the Resident Evil 7 kitchen demo in VR. You were just completely powerless and tied to a chair. It was also my first VR horror experience. Of course, once I had done it, I knew I had to get my older brother, who loves horror, to do it as well. And then I tapped him slightly on the neck to make it even worse for him. Well played. Well played and good show. Yeah, that demo is great for, like, getting, you know, showing somebody what VR is like without them needing to control anything. It's literally just like a 5-minute little, I would call it a haunted house, but it's a haunted house that happens around you.
Yeah, tapping on the neck just reminds me, I think my favorite video game review I've ever read was, I think it was crack.com did a review of Alien Isolation where the person playing it, you know, played it in a dark room with the addition of, like, having his cat in the room with him so that he would randomly jump out at him.
Just put it in some kind of cat cannon. Oh man. And round us out here, Ben, what does Ricky say?
Ricky says Soma isn't the scariest game in that I was never actually afraid while playing it, unlike Amnesia, which I had to occasionally pause and remind myself it was just a video game. But it is the horror-iest game I have ever played. It was this amazing slow burn that sticks with you because of the questions it raises about the nature of humanity and what a person is. Some of the people, or quote-unquote people, you encounter in the game are the closest thing to a real-world hell, which I can imagine.
Yeah, you run into some fucked-up scenarios, which is why you go around pulling plugs. Mercy kill everybody, baby. Yes, existential horror, it's rare. Also, sad horror is rare.
Soma added to my wish list.
It's good. It's a really good game. I might have a copy of it.
We are now up to 2 references to pulling life support this
That's a running joke for me on streams and also on Watch Out for Fireballs. I very much pull plugs in games. I decided that power is mine. You know, the only thing stopping me from being a god is me deciding that I cannot be a god. Once I change that, then, you know.
So how do you like Life is Strange?
Oh no.
I'm not going to talk about the ending of that game because I don't want to spoil it because I think people should play it. Let's see here. Yeah, so mine, I'm going to be more in line with the people who talk about Soma because, like, there are games that really got under my skin and gave me the willies and made me need to stop playing them. But, like, if we're talking about a kind of horror that really sticks with me, something that is a little bit more has more to do with like the tone and the scenario than anything. Something more like novelistic, like Pathologic, something as bleak as Pathologic, something as bleak as like a Lisa the Painful RPG as well. You know, so like Pathologic, in the way that it just really gets under your skin how terrible things go in spite of your best efforts, and how much it wears you down, and how much the mechanics just really force you into this sense of feeling the deprivation that everybody around you is facing. And the way that it plays with what is real and what is not, and how much you are kind of a plaything in the hands of fate as it goes, is something that really sticks with you. Again, existentially, like in Soma. And then in Lisa, the Painful RPG, just with its entire concept that is entirely just how awful people will be to each other in that scenario, with very little actually going on in terms of like super science and stuff. Like literally the only like supernatural things are the drug that people are taking that is mutating them, and like the event that killed all of the women, right? Everything else is people being fucking monsters to each other. So it's kind of like a real Lord of the Flies, but writ large kind of thing. Yeah, so I would say those, Pathologic and Lisa the Painful RPG. Ben, how about you?
All right, I got two answers from when I was a kid, and then one answer from when I was older. Answers when I was a kid, the Doom brain alien thing with like the horns on it.
Yeah.
That thing scared me as a kid. I was always scared when I was taking a shower that it would be like right behind me and stuff. The nurse bleeding from orifices in Silent Hill 1.
Oh yeah, Lisa.
Yeah, that freaked the shit out of me. And especially because that was like the highest fidelity graphics I'd seen at that point in my life, and so I was just like, man, that's terrible. And then, yeah, cut to the game shot of him just like standing bracing the door as she's trying to get out. It's just like fucked up. More recent example is Dead Space. I screamed so many times playing that game, so that's just like objectively scarier than any other game I've played, I think.
He stole mine!
So I was going to cite Dead Space, and I think in particular, I don't know, I would actually say less for the actual core scariness, and more for like, I think it does a great job of just having a lot of like unremitting intensity to its action.
I just remember the feeling where they're like, oh, now you got to backtrack to this area. And I'm just like, no,
oh, no.
Damn it. No. Getting, I'm safe right here. I'm
getting
stay
here was hard enough.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Ben, on Slack, I DM'd you a key for Soma.
Oh my.
Yes.
Thanks,
I already had, I had a copy laying around on Humble. Don't thank me too much. It was just laying there. So I do not feel obligated to play it. You just mentioned looking to go get it. So for all of you, Dead Space is one of them, it seems.
Yeah, I think the... Oh, gone.
I was going to say that specifically one part sticks out in my mind, which I probably couldn't take you there in the game, but you're kind of entering a hallway and you just start hearing this like, doom, doom. And there's someone at the far end of the hallway just standing there smacking their head against a pipe facing away from you, and you have to traverse this entire hallway towards them to get where you're going next, kind of knowing that they're going to turn around, that something's going to come out, like this is not good. And it's never been so hard in my life to hold a stick forward. And since that point, like whenever I think of horror in a video game, that image is kind of emblematic of just that whole genre for me.
Yeah,
that one, if I remember correctly, that scene also has kind of an interesting payoff too.
The thing in Dead Space that gets me is in Dead Space 2 when you have to jam the needle into your eye.
Yeah, that's not pleasant.
No, it's actually one of the most upsetting things.
Yeah, body horror underrated.
No, body horror is great.
Yeah, unless you're Junjito, in which case maybe a little overrated. maybe see someone about that.
did anybody else have another one? I mean, it sounds like all of you said Dead Space. So
two other honorable mentions. One would be Eternal Darkness. One is just a great game, and also was fairly early in the, you know, me being interested in Lovecraft stuff.
Yeah.
Similarly, I don't know if there's like, this had a big impact on me, but more in terms of just introducing me to things. There was definitely a straight a line for me from the weird, like, use map settings, the thing map on StarCraft to the thing video game to actually watching the thing movie. And that was probably the first, like, I don't know, what you might call, like, core horror movie I ever saw. And is still one of my favorite movies.
Well, it's a really good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, a great cliffhanger ending.
Can we do a small side note? Or I know we usually do our diversions at the beginning of the podcast, but I want to do one now.
Okay.
I saw Invasion of the Body Snatchers for the first time over the weekend.
Oh, yeah?
How'd that hold up?
It's not bad. It's not a bad movie, but the entire time I was comparing it to The Thing and thinking how much better The Thing was than they show horror like in the wrong places in that movie. You know, like, they show like the kind of like the grotesqueness and explain like how a body can be formed in that, and it's like, okay, that's fine, but like it's more effective when you don't show that. Like,
yeah.
And The Thing, it's great because you never really see the people explicitly get assimilated. Like, you just see like terrible tiny details of it and just leave the rest up to your imagination, and you just see that like dog fucking head split open like a flower, and it's terrible.
Which version of Body Snatchers did you see? Was the 70s one with Donald Sutherland?
Yes.
That one's great. I love that one. Mm-hmm.
So speaking of The Thing, we should stream Among Us.
Yeah, sure. Okay, cool. So thank you everybody for writing in, and I hope that you have a good Halloween. If you would like to participate in these in the future, go to facebook.com/thelevelpodcast and watch for the questions to go up on Monday afternoons. Thank you, Dennis, for putting this one up.
My pleasure.
The end boss.
Now it is time for the end boss, where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games around us that are exciting to us. I will do mine here very quickly, because it's more of just a thing happens, but I had no idea that there was a Kickstarter campaign for a board game adaptation of Frostpunk, one of my favorite games to come out in the past 5 years. People had asked in a couple of different places, like, ooh, what video game board game would you like to play? And I talked about, like, yeah, Frostpunk would be a good one. Like, that seems like it would be an interesting, you know, either solo or co-op kind of game. It feels like it would translate pretty well, and totally, it's a thing that you can order. It's not going to be shipping until October of 2021, which is a bummer, and I'm trying to decide if I want to pay for the miniatures when just the non non-expensive one would do.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's as of the time of recording, it has a little bit more than a day left, but I'm sure they're going to be doing a post fund kind of thing. But the campaign has been wildly successful. They have made, let's see here, they have made $2.5 million against a basically a $250,000 goal for this really intricate board game. So there's lots of love out there for the stuff that's involved here. And I am here for it.
I'm one of those people that just, like, I could care less about whether or not the game has miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
but I know people geek out for miniatures.
Yeah.
Well, more importantly, people shell out.
Yeah. Game design, 1 to 4 players, 60 plus minutes, 16 plus. So you can play this solo.
Neat. Yeah, baby, join the solo mafia.
See, I feel like with Fusspunk, I wouldn't want actual miniatures. However, if there was no game, but just like a kit for building a diorama Fusspunk city.
Oh, that'd rule.
I would buy that. Yeah.
I want a miniature corpse pit.
Well, I mean, don't let your dreams stay dreams, man. Yeah. Ben, what's going on with Cyberpunk?
Yeah, so this was like news that's very relevant to today, because I think it was announced today that Cyberpunk's being delayed 21 days. So the release date, instead of being November 19th, is going to be December 10th. So heads up for people planning on taking vacation time for this.
Yeah,
I was actually considering it. I was like, maybe I should take off like the week of Thanksgiving, so I could kind of like post up and play this a whole bunch. I still might do that, but it might be in December now. So yeah. I'm actually kind of slightly excited about this too, because I was making plans for this. I'm like, man, I gotta find a PS5, and there's only like a week between that coming out and this coming out, and they're all like sold out. So
yeah.
I'm just going to say, you know, that's days after baby Barrett is going to show up, and I'm not going to be sleeping anyway. So,
this is
perfect timing.
Neat.
Yeah. I mean, Cyberpunk seems like the ideal thing to be sleep deprived on.
With Barrett, I'm going to go back to the golden age where kids don't care what's on the screen. Like, they're too young to know. So I just got to figure out what to do with the other two.
Yeah. Just set up Slay the Spire in another room.
Dennis, what's please tell me how esports have stayed completely pure and free of corruption.
Yeah, and like just mind-boggling that someone would do this. There's I guess grand finals are coming up for Rainbow Six Siege, which is one of the many games looking to have a serious competitive scene, and you know, one of the teams that was just stomping early on in their final qualifier match just kind of seemed off, couldn't pull it together, lost the match. And then their head coach just kind of on Twitter was like, oh, yeah, we threw that so we'd get better seating, which is expressly against everything that competitive gaming stands for, and expressly called out in the rule book is like, I think it's a $5,000 fine and a 12-month ban maximum.
Yeah. See, the thing is, if you don't admit it, they can't prove that you did it.
This just shows how far esports is from being ready to be a legitimate competitive scene. That a head coach of a team, what's that?
The fact that they got caught, you mean?
No. Just the lack of understanding of what it means to be a serious competitive organization.
Yeah.
I was going to argue that this is showing the opposite. This is legitimizing them, that like people are becoming this corrupt around it and betting on themselves. It's like, oh, this is like an actual sport now.
Like this wasn't like all this was for was like for a better, like a better standing in the tournament. Like,
yeah, for seeding.
Far be it for me to like, and this is a Japanese team, so I don't know what their sports culture is over there. But like, you know, when I saw the headline for this, I just pictured that it was an American. And it's like, I don't want to shame somebody for not being into sports, but like, this is a place where it would really like benefit you to have a little bit of a historical understanding of sports. Like, just like, to, you know, somebody was talking about this, just diffuse the entire situation by saying, Pete Rose, dog.
Yeah.
Remember, you know, the story of Pete Rose? Because like, you're about to do that thing. And
yes,
I don't like
ridiculous.
If the tournament's set up in a way where you losing gives you a better advantage down the road, I think that's a problem in the tournament, and they're just doing like whatever. Like, for some reason, I'm not.
So
like,
how do you feel about March Madness?
I don't. That's the thing, because I don't follow much sports.
The exact same way. It should be like a basic tournament, or ideally a challenge system.
But in March Madness, so the, like the worse you play, the higher ranked team you have to play, right?
I think the specific scenario was that the Uber team that they were going to be up against lost.
Yeah.
So they knew that the Uber team was was going to come in lower seeded. And so to decrease the odds that they were going to have to see that team early on, they threw a game.
Yeah, so this isn't a problem necessarily with the tournament design. They were not in the tournament and losing for advantage. This is in the lead up, right?
It impacted their seeding in the tournament.
Yes, there we go.
See, I still feel like maybe.
I guess I should clarify. It did not make them being worse seeded. Did not make things better for them, except for the fact that a team that was expected to be overpowered was seeded lower than expected as well.
Right.
Yeah. For some reason, I guess I'm not as upset about this because even that rationale doesn't really hold up, right? Because if they're supposed to be this Uber team, either they're throwing as well to go in the lower ends. I don't know why. Or they're not as good of a team because they got beaten, right?
Yeah. Or they just had a bad day and got, you know, they fucked up. But yeah. Like it's still upsetting to me because if you have like if this is a tactic people are using, like it the entire structure of the league ceases to be a way to find the people who are best at playing the game.
So there's that level of it going on, and then there's the level that the head coach would just be so unaware that would be a bad thing to do, that they just kind of casually out themselves on Twitter, like, oh yeah, we did the bad thing.
Yeah.
It didn't even seem like it took a lot of provocation. Like literally someone else tweeted like, oh, look how the standings could have fallen out. So it's actually not so bad for them if they lost. And then the head coach chimed in with like, yep, that's why we did it.
Yeah.
Don't coaches do that all the time? Like I find football, like all the time coaches were transparent that like, oh, we're, you know, strategically using our timeouts to run down the clock.
And, that's a different thing than saying we're losing on purpose.
Is it?
It's not. If they're not like betting on themselves to like lose or something like that, I think this is actually okay. I don't see anything wrong with this.
Yeah, I think I'm with Ben on this one.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know how I feel about that.
If they're like betting on themselves to lose and then they take a dive, yeah, I think that's terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
I still think this should. Well, they should just
a tournament with a huge cash prize system.
Like you challenge the top ranked team. If you win, you become the top ranked team.
Yeah, like they're not doing something where it's like they're trying to like split the win with someone else and send them to first place or anything. They're just trying to navigate to first place in a weird way where they like try and go to the lower bracket first and then win.
Yeah,
but I mean they still have to fight, beat other people, and I assume at some point they have to fight this Uber team that they're talking about.
But like, but they're putting the other team in a worse position as a result of that. So like, how are you? Like, if this is a strategy that is out there, yeah, no, I think we should stop going around on this. We can be split on it. It's fine.
Oh yeah. But it's just, again, it makes this feels like a step backwards for esports, and it reveals just how immature that scene is for a category of entertainment that is trying to be much more grown up.
Yeah. And man, even if you're not into sports, like the coolest thing about sports is like all of the crime and cheating and like scandal and stuff. Like that's the stuff that you can follow as like a human story. Man.
Wait, so you're saying that this shows that esports is ready for the prime time?
No, I'm what I'm intending to say, I feel like that is an important clarification. What I'm intending to say is that you know, being aware of different ways that people get caught fucking around, it's not just good for you to understand that, but it's also entertaining to read about the ways people fuck around.
I look at this the same way I look at like problems like in the government, where it's like, I should expect people to be selfish and not great, and you should set up a system that limits their ability to do that as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And like here, I see it as a failure of the system and not a failure of like the team. I guess
it's a race to zero. That's very, now we're getting way like theoretical about it. But it's like a race to zero of just assuming everyone will act in bad faith all the time is a difficult world to live in.
Yeah. Welcome to game theory.
Yeah.
David, did you have anything?
Yeah, so I had on the kind of strategy of, you know, ending with our downer stories, did you see it's come out that if you have a Oculus whatever and you will now be required to hook it up to your Facebook account. And what? If you ever cancel or delete your Facebook account, you instantly lose all the games that you own.
That has to change. That is bullshit.
Wow.
So this is kind of like a, well, I'm not trying to cut in with my opinion on every story here, but I think, like, in general, I'm like, don't trust any big tech companies for anything. Like, don't buy music through them. Buy an actual album or whatever. Because, like, all of these things are, like, promises of, like, yeah, we'll have this feature forever. And then, like, 5 or 10 years later, you're like, yeah, we're going to scrap this feature. Sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, this is, like, this sucks. You know, I think about it. I think about the way that it affects me personally. I have an Oculus Quest. I have bought several games on it. You know, if you want to play,
you rented several games on it.
Yeah. So, yeah. I have spent money to have access to several games on it. I have no intention of, like, outright deleting my Facebook account. That is not for lack of wanting to. Like, that company gives plenty of, like, it gives plenty of reasons to not want to have anything to do with them. But, like, you know, any number of reasons. But, like, still, I hate the fact that just. I don't understand why that would be like what do they gain from being that shitty about it.
They're trying to keep as many users who are probably leaving their platform.
I mean
in other news, there's been some talk of, you know, regulating some of these things, so
that'd be cool. I'd like that, please.
Did you guys hear the DOJ filed an antitrust complaint against Google last week?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. I've heard varying themes on how much it is just posturing versus anything else, but yeah.
I don't trust this DOJ to do anything right or for the right reasons, while also believing that big tech needs to... I would love to see a resurgence of any kind of antitrust law enforcement ever in this country, and I think that tech would be a good place to do it. Hopefully, yeah, we'll be in a position where we will have a better DOJ soon who can pick up that mantle.
Yeah, I've been shocked recently just at the degree to which Google search just doesn't work as a search engine anymore.
It's pretty bad.
Wait, why is it bad?
It is now an exceptional case that I'm able to find what I'm looking for. Instead, I'm finding, like, basically all you get in the top matches are Alibaba, Amazon, and like a bunch of search engine optimized, you know, content mills.
Yeah, or it's like more like kind of like paid advertisements than it is like natural responses.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. There's a pattern with, like, all these types of services where when they come out, they're supposed to be, like, very, very, like, easy to use with, like, low cost, like high happiness value and, like, low, like, there's, like, nothing wrong with it, like, very frictionless, you know? I'm thinking of, like, Google Music in particular when that first came out, like, 10 years ago or whatever. Yeah. It's like, oh, I can put all my music here, it's no problem. But then, like, as they get people, and the reason why it's like that is to get users onboarded and stuff. But then after you have all the users, that's when you start doing things like having advertisements or getting other ways of, like, getting money from all the users you have on there now. And then, like, it degrades the service over time and it becomes, like, a bad experience, you know?
Everything is just a trap to lure you in so they can take advantage of you.
Yeah. All right, that was a sad story, David.
Yeah, it's fucking sucks,
something,
dude.
Late stage capitalism, something, something.
Here, silver lining though, video games don't do that. You buy a product that is done. You know what I mean? And for the most part, right? There's exceptions, but like Cyberpunk, for example, or like, I don't know, Subnautica or something. The games that are like done, they're not trying to advertise something to you. They're focusing on like the experience of the gameplay and that being quality. So.
So I think that we need to cut this one off because we could continue going on for this one.
Pull the plug, Cole.
I will. How do you all feel about buttoning it up?
Button it. The credit.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode of The Level. We really appreciate you taking the time. As a reminder, again, we are going to be taking next week off in order to doom scroll. I'm not going to lie. I'm taking next week off in order to doom scroll. in the meantime, as you're listening, if you live in the United States, please, for the love of God, go out, vote. Endless hell, please. Like, let us get started in a good direction again. If you're not in the United States, pray for us.
That's coming from Cole, not a religious person.
Right. Yeah, it can't hurt. So, you know the things you can do other than voting and praying. You can leave ratings or reviews in Apple Podcasts. You can tell your friends about the show. Patreon.com/DuckFeedTV. All of that is good stuff. We're going to be putting together plans for DuckStream here soon because of COVID stuff. Mm-hmm. It's going to be probably a more remote, virtual kind of thing. But we'll get it figured out. Keep your ear to the ground on that, folks here, and also Jala. We'll probably be having conversations about that as we look for dates that might work for the biggest number of people. Otherwise,
prime window for Among Us streaming.
Oh, it would be. That'd be a very good time. Anyway, keep your eye for that. Anyway, I have been Cole. You can follow my tweets on Twitter at Cole Ross.
I've been Dennis. You can find me on Twitch at Deck of Wonders.
I have been David, and you can only find me if you vote, so do it.
I've been Ben at Nowhere.
and stick around for some titles. Okay. I only have one, I think. Let me go back to my notes here. When God nukes a door.
That's the same one I have.
That's the one I didn't write any down, but that was the one that I had filed in my memory.
Okay.
It's gotta be that.
Dennis, did you have any others?
I literally had one written down and that was it.
Okay, Dave, did you have any?
No.
Okay, when God nukes a door, it is.
Oh, wow. Let's hope the election next week is that unanimous.
Yeah.
Cool, guys. All right, I'm gonna go. I need to lay down. I'm sleepy.
Ben, I might try to squeeze in some Nowhere Profit before I go to bed. I don't know if you're interested in seeing.
Yeah, I'll watch it.
Okay, cool. We'll just hang out here then.
All right, later, everybody.
Good night, guys.
Bye.
Peace.